Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 42 degrees with rain. In New York City, 37 degrees with light rain. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for Advocating for Justice with Arthur Schwartz coming up very shortly. Just wanted to remind people again that if you haven't done it yet, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this institution that has been around since 1960. For those people who are not doing the math, that means WBAI has been around being part of the Pacifica Radio Network, giving the metro area a distinctive sound, a Pacifica-type branding broadcasting for 63 years. Yes, this month marked that we turn another birthday. WBAI has been part of the Pacifica Radio Network since 1960. So 63 years. And those 63 years could not have happened if it wasn't for listeners like yourselves so diligently supporting this institution. 212-209-2950 is the number to call to show your support of this institution. 212-209-2950, or go to give to WBAI.org online. Now, I'm not going to go into a long-winded spiel about why WBAI should be something supported because, well, if you're listening, well, you should know. I mean, the cable news networks are trash. I'm just going to call it for what it is. Anyone who takes information from the cable news network should take it with a huge grain of salt, because it is very ironic that the terminology of misinformation gets thrown out around, and they are yet the biggest culprit of that. I said it. I challenge anyone that tells me otherwise. I ain't scared of no one. 212-209-2950. Or go to give to WBAI.org online is the number. All right, enough of that. Let's go into the program. Stay tuned for Advocating for Justice coming up.
You're living in times where men commit crimes and crime don't have a face. We live in a political world, icicles hanging down, wedding bells ringing, angels singing, clouds cover up the ground.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Arthur Schwartz here in New York on Advocating for Justice on WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And I like to say 99.5 FM in New York and far from New York. I actually have a cousin who told me he listens to WBAI and he lives in the middle of Connecticut somewhere. And he sent me an email the other night. Was that you I heard on the radio after Democracy Now? And on WBAI.org, we can be heard everywhere, including where our first guest tonight is. He's up in Syracuse, and he's got all his friends listening on WBAI.org to our show. But just to pick up on where Reggie didn't want to go, WBAI is a unique institution. It's unique except for the other similar radio stations that are in the Pacifica, either owned by Pacifica or in the Pacifica, I'm going to call it the Pacifica Network, about 200 stations all over the country. We are listener supported. We don't take instructions from We have to take some instructions from the FCC, a little bit. Like, we're not allowed to, certain words we're not allowed to say on the air. And we have to run our station in a manner that, as a nonprofit, that comports with their rules. But they don't tell us what to say other than those six banned words. And we tell it like it is. And we have guests on the air who give you a version of reality, because we all have different versions of reality. I don't know, from Santos is now more, even more extreme than Donald Trump. But we, on this radio station, you have people who interview people, bring news, bring stories, bring cultural issues, bring medical issues, play music that is, you're not going to hear anywhere else. And it's been going on since 1960. When I was a kid, when I was a teenager, I used to listen to WBAI to find out what the most recent demonstration was going on in the anti-war movement. And there were even people that would somehow be reporting in those days. This is like before cell phones. They'd be reporting from demonstrations that were marching down the street. They'd probably have to go to pay phones and call in a report. This station is dedicated to bringing you a perspective on the world, the perspective on New York you're not going to find anywhere else. And we're only going to continue to exist because people donate money. People get online, they make phone calls. Just ask everyone today, go online. We need the money. It costs $1.5 million a year just to run this station. And that's with very few, almost every producer like me as a volunteer. We need to pay our board operators like Reggie. We need to pay, you know, the senior staff of all two of them. We need to pay our rent. We need to pay our tower, the tower rent and the rent of our studios. And it costs $1.5 million a year. So please go to WBAI.org, become a WBAI buddy, and keep us on the air. Now, our first guest today is someone I've actually known for more than 6 years. And he's only like 26 years old. No, he's all of about 30. Maurice Brown. Good afternoon, Maurice.
How's it going, Arthur? Thank you for having me. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we'll hear you fine. And Maurice is up in Syracuse area. You know, some of you don't know where Syracuse is. It's actually up on the edge of Lake Ontario, up on the northern.
We're not that far north.
We're on the northern end of New York. It snows there a lot more than it does in New York City.
Yes.
And Mo has been a progressive political activist for much of the last, you know, 10 years. He got out of high school. He served in the military. He got out of the military. He went to college and then he started doing political organizing. Most recently, he was the regional director for the Working Families Party. And he is now running he's not starting at Congress like some impetuous young people. He's starting at the county legislature.
Yes, sir.
Take my word for it. When he gets in there, he's going to move up fast. So, Mo, before I start, I wanted to play this video. It's your campaign video. Yeah. People won't see it, but they can hear what you have to say on your website. This is how you describe who you are and what you're trying to do.
Yes, sir. I'll hear it.
So many times here in Syracuse, the narrative is around what we can't do. We can't get rid of all the lead. We can't have efficient transportation. We can't move to renewables. I refuse to accept that. My name is Maurice Brown, and I'm running to change that narrative. After my second military deployment, I bought my house here in the city of Syracuse because I believe in this community. I believe we deserve a bikeable, walkable community with mixed income housing where affordable housing isn't just a buzzword. A bus rapid transit system where missing the bus doesn't mean missing an entire day of work. These are some of the many priorities we can achieve if we're willing to work together. Together, we can build a future to believe in. Let's get to work.
So, Mo, tell us, Chris, how would you describe yourself? Who are you?
My name is Maurice Brown. How would I describe myself? An organizer. I'm going to work. I like to think that I'm a worker and, someone who cares, someone who's been paying attention to these issues for a while now. And you just get fed up seeing, you know, things take its course and you want to get involved. You want to act. So yeah, I'm an actor, you know, someone who's going to do things.
So yeah. you're Syracuse, most people in the county legislature is Onondaga, but most people don't even know how to say that, much as spell it. Onondaga County.
Yes, sir.
Is where Syracuse is. Syracuse is what, like the fourth largest city in the state?
Yes, sir.
And it's in pretty bad shape, no?
Yes, sir. We have some marks you don't want to have as far as concentrated poverty. Minority poverty as well. Children, you know, born into certain zip codes are more likely to get asthma than they are not to get asthma because of our lead situation being so bad. But, you know, it's not all bad, but we got to be realistic with the problems that are in front of us and how to solve them.
And what about in terms of, so you're African-American.
Yes, sir.
I know that my legal work recently has expanded over to Rochester and Buffalo, where we have discovered an incredibly racist community. How does that, you know, play out in the Syracuse and in Onondaga County?
How do I expect the racism to play out?
Yeah.
Cut off for a bit. So luckily, like, I'll go back. So, yes, upstate New York, there is a lot of racism, both overt and non-overt. You know, we get it all. But luckily, you know, I'm in the city of Syracuse. So the city of Syracuse is a very, you know, diverse place. We speak over 100 languages here. We're a sanctuary city. We have, you know, refugees coming from Ukraine to the Horn of Africa. And we have a strong African-American community here. And, you know, we all work together. I am expecting it. You know, we're getting some of the less overt racism even throughout this campaign. But, you know, I'm not running to end racism. I would like to end racism. That is a priority. But right now my priority is, you know, helping Syracuse as much as possible, getting the county legislature back on track. So, you know, I know it's coming. It comes with the territory. It's just, you know, what happens when you're a person of color and you start making a positive change. But, you know, I'm not going to let them be my priority at all. Cause that's
so silly. So you've been an organizer. We met in 2016. Yes, you were a,
Bernie delegate.
You ran to be a delegate to the Democratic Convention. You were probably, yes, what, about 26 years old?
Yes, sir.
And you won. You went to the Democratic Convention and not that far away. It was in Philadelphia that year.
Yes, sir.
And you've been the regional director for the Working Families Party. Why did you decide to start with a run for county legislature as opposed to some other more fancy
seat? Yes, sir. So in the city of Syracuse, you know, there's a lot of problems that we face. And the ones that are most important to me are the ones that impact my community the most. They're the ones around poverty. Our transportation conversation is, you know, bare. We literally have bus stops that see one or two buses a day. Like, it's real hard to move around the county. And in 2020, when the American Rescue Plan relief funds were released, the ARPA funds, Chuck Schumer and, you know, the federal representative, they gave a good amount of money to the city of Syracuse, to Onondaga County, And that money was meant to help people. They wanted it to help people. But here in Onondaga County, we have a county executive who's a Republican. And then we have a gerrymandered county legislature map where 11 Republicans outnumber the 6 Democrats. And they really just drive through their agenda. And instead of using that money to help people, they used it to get an aquarium. They're trying to get a sports complex. They pretty much, there's a pattern of taking money from social services, taking money from DSS, taking money from that safety net that people rely on, and then using it to fund these big, you know, ribbon cutter events. And seeing that, it was messed up. I didn't like it. We had problems on the state level too. Actually, when I first got in 2018, I worked on Senator Rachel May's campaign. I'm so proud. But the state is doing a much better job now that we have Rachel there. And she doesn't have a counterpart on the legislature like how I'll be. We have Mary Kuhn, but she's retiring, and, you know, Linda Irvin, some other really good Democrats. But we need a progressive champion on our county level, and that's who I'm going to be.
What are you, the little station ID, this is Arthur Schwartz on Advocating for Justice, 99.5 FM. Yes. NWBAI.org, and we're talking to Maurice Brown, who's running for the Onondaga County Legislature, which is
up in
Syracuse yes, area. Hey, I'm from the Bronx. I could say it any way I want.
Yes, sir.
So talk about your campaign. How are you organizing people to win?
Yes, sir. So our issues, I try to be as clear and easy as possible. I'm talking about transportation and housing. It's funny because I'm running in the city of Syracuse, but if you did it blind test, it'll sound like I'm running in Brooklyn. It'll sometimes sound like, you know, I'm running out in the rural areas as well, because our struggle is, you know, more collective than we realize. We're dealing with dilapidated housing. We're dealing with, you know, landlords that won't take Section 8 tenants. We're dealing with landlords that refuse to improve their housing. And in these fights, you know, in this collective struggle, we're building a lot of allies. You know, people are seeing the work that I've done in the community. People are seeing what I'm going to do, what I want to do. And, you know, we're building a pretty strong team. I've already been endorsed by Senator Rachel May. I've been endorsed by several local officials, community leaders, Ricky Brown, Palmer Harvey of the Syracuse Tenants Union. And in building this coalition, you know, what we're working to do is, one, get more votes than our opponent, but also take it past Election Day. Like, it's not enough just to get more votes and then just go and be, you know, another check for the Democrat box. Like, we need to organize our people in a way that, you know, we can have this energy and we're able to move the needle on the issues that matter to us. And that's what we've been doing. It's been fun. You know, we know petitioning is coming at the beginning of March. So getting ready for that. We don't have official days yet, but it's usually around then. So getting the team ready for that. We've had a fundraiser house party, and we're going to have another one towards the end of March. But, you know, we're going to push really hard. We're going to get as many people involved, because the issues we're facing, we can't take them on alone. I say it a bunch of times, but the Democratic Party, we have to build out our bench. We need more people, you know, who are different, who are diverse, who bring different skills to the table, and then we have to use them all. And I'm going to do that. I'm going to mush the door open, and then I'm going to prop it open and leave it open so that many more people can come after me. And we've been doing that.
So how do you address, I don't think I've been in Syracuse in 5 or 6 years. The last time I was there, okay, it seemed like two towns. One was around Syracuse University, okay, you know, a lot of shops and stores and restaurants. And then there was the rest of Syracuse,
yes, sir,
which seemed run down. And this is before the pandemic. Closed stores, boarded up buildings, dilapidated housing. Mm-hmm. I would assume the pandemic didn't help.
You are correct. The pandemic did not help things, but you know, we're turning around up in Syracuse. Things aren't as, you know, doom and gloom as they once were. I'll credit Senator Rachel May and her work, helping move issues like bus rapid transit, helping, you know, move the issues that we care about. But I'll also, you know, I'll give credit where it's due. Folks like Joe Driscoll, folks like our mayor, Mayor Walsh. We've been taking steps in order to get there. We're still a very segregated community, and the university is just one part of that segregation. And it's definitely something we need to work on, but we're taking steps. You know, we're no stranger to NIMBYism. We get that up here where, you know, folks don't want, you know, development in their backyards, and we have to have those fights, and we still do. But, you know, the city is pushing towards mixed use. We just recently opened the Sault City Market in the last couple years, and beautiful mixed use building, serves food, has a community space for gatherings, and more things like that are happening in this community. You know, I'm not going to be the one to say, like, you know, Syracuse is getting back on the map. I won't do all of that, but Syracuse is moving in the right direction. We're just not moving fast enough. So I'm going to be a part of that. The ball is sort of rolling, and my plan is to push it as hard as I can so that we can, you know, break those patterns that we face historically in order to, you know, have a better community.
So what, when you took down here, I'm not sure we people know, what is bus rapid transit?
Yes, sir. So a bus, so in Syracuse, so I was born in Brooklyn, New York. I'll say that I was born on Green and Stuyvesant, to those who know Brooklyn, but I live in Syracuse now and I love it. Syracuse is my home. Coming from Brooklyn, New York, with such a robust transportation system that has its own issues, but in comparison to what we have, it's night and day. I have a student that she couldn't get to her 8 a.m. class at all because the bus literally would not get there that early. Like, the earliest bus to get to our campus, to OCC, was at 8:45. There was nothing she could do. And that's messed up. We're failing people. So a bus rapid transit system is a system that finds the most common corridors in the city, and then it basically sends buses down those corridors very frequently. I'm talking 10, 15 minutes, which in Syracuse talk, that's very frequently. I know that's pretty much every bus in New York City, but for us, it's a big deal. And, you know, we're excited to have it. The corridors are headed towards OCC, towards the hub, the downtown Syracuse area. And, you know, if you miss the bus, it's not the end of the world. There's going to be another one coming right afterwards. And it's real progress because, you know, poverty is linked to transportation. There's direct studies that show that, you know, as far as moving out of poverty, the proximity to a bus stop is like direct. The shorter your commute, the more likely you are to make it up. So the fact that we're able to do that for people is huge, and it's going to make real change for our community, and I'm happy to be a part of it.
In terms of housing,
yeah,
how do you see your, what kind of housing programs are you pushing? So that, you know, everybody's for housing, right? Yes, Governor Hochul's for housing, right? Every developer is for housing, right? They want to build housing. We'll give a little bit of, we'll give 20% mm-hmm. affordable apartments,
yep.
you know, and the rest.
It's like affordable housing.
Right. We both made air quotes. how do you see approaching housing in a way that isn't just turning some section of Syracuse back into, a wealthier community?
Yes, sir. So there's a lot of ways you can go about it. There's a lot of ideas we can do as far as creating new housing. But me personally, I want to push for not restoring, but taking care of the housing stock we have right now. And a lot of that's going to be holding landlords accountable, because when things break, they don't want to fix it. It's easier to just eject that tenant and bring in a new one instead of fixing that landlord up. So we need to do that. We have a codes enforcement bureau that checks for, you know, deficiencies in apartments. And when they find them, we need to give our codes enforcement the ability to enforce. You know, they need teeth. They need to be able to do more than just fine, than just, you know, say you're a bad property. They need to be able to do more than that. Going forward, obviously I'm going to promote mixed use housing. On the county level, we don't get to touch zoning. That's city and towns, but there are things the county can do with a carrot to incentivize more, diverse zoning, not just single family property, getting mixed income, getting low income housing in the same building as, affordable housing. And I can talk about this for a long time. I don't want to go in circles, but we have to take care of the housing we have now, full stop. And then we have to, going forward, promote less luxury housing and more mixed use, more affordable housing, even low income housing, because, people need a place to live. If they don't have a roof over their head, it's hard to address those other problems. So we got to take care of our people.
On a county legislature,
yes, sir.
What about education? Mm-hmm. What can you do in the county legislature about education?
So the Onondaga County So in Onondaga County, there are several school districts. So I'm located within the Syracuse City School District, but we also have the Fayetteville Manlius School District in the suburbs, the Liverpool District. The county doesn't operate with the school districts aside from providing them funding. So some of us really creative people want us to consolidate that. There was actually a big consensus push and folks in the suburbs were against it. But in the city of Syracuse, our graduation rate, I want to say it's around 60. And if you go 5-6 miles east, that graduation rate jumps to 95. I don't think your zip code should determine, how far you go. So fundamentally, there's a lot of things the county can do, getting creative and taxing like that as far as allocation of resources. But short term, we really don't have much say on what the schools do unless major changes are happening. And I don't know if we're there yet as a region.
One last question. Because I know this is a big issue in Rochester, the police and public safety, public safety versus misconduct. Mm-hmm. What kind of issue is that, and how does that affect your race?
So public safety is a huge deal in our area. We recently lost an 11-year-old child to gun violence on Martin Luther King down here, Brexie. And it hurts, it hurts because the policing issue is so complicated. The police budget, like in New York City, it takes up the lion's share of our city's budget. And I don't think we're getting a good bang for our buck. I say this a bunch where folks criticize me because I'm a, defund the police guy, but I'm not a defund the police guy because police are bad or anything like that. I want them to do better. And if they won't do better, we should use that money for after school programs. We should use that money for other things. In Syracuse, the cops don't really walk the beat. You'll rarely see a cop on foot. They hang out in their cars. They, chill, and they basically are like a quick reaction force. Like they hear the calls and then they go. But a large part of policing is presence. So we need more presence, but we got to be smart with it. We can't just keep throwing money at the problem. So yeah, public safety is a huge issue. However, I will say on the Onondaga County Legislature, we're separate from the City of Syracuse Police Department, and getting the Onondaga County Sheriff to coordinate with the Syracuse Police Department better is one of my priorities. I think they should, work together, and there's ways they can without, fully stepping on each other's toes. The one that comes right to mind is the 911 services. But there's a lot of things that can be done as far as public safety. Generating the political will to do them is hard. And it's tough because we can't really have the conversation about public safety, because whenever you criticize the police, you're anti-police, you're anti-union, and they just try and throw you under the ground where, I'm an educator. I work at OCC. I get criticized daily, and I want to be criticized so I can be better. And I think we got to think of public safety like that too. We failed. We failed. We couldn't keep Brexie safe, and we need to figure out what we need to do better to protect our people going forward. I'm hoping to engage in that conversation. I know we're going to keep having it as a community, but figuring out what that next step is not, you know, there is no silver bullet. Yes, sir. Oh, you're muted.
We could, I was going to say, we could keep talking, but the show must move on. So thank you so much for coming on. We'll check in with you later in this. I know your election is until June.
Yes, sir. It's
important to WBAI that we, you know, we reach out to all parts of New York State and not just, mm-hmm. just to New York City. And we want to stay on top of your race. Best of luck.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, get that petitioning done and don't get too cold. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Arthur. Have a good one.
So as we, last Thursday or Friday, David Crosby died. And maybe I'm dating myself, but to me, David Crosby, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, the Byrds, really defined a whole generation of people that I was at the young end of during a period of immense turbulence in the United States, and the music reflected that. So just as a little break from my my DJ 3 minutes, I'm going to play a little piece of Long Time Coming by Crosby, Stills. You got to reach out to end the madness. Take it away, Randy. Again, that was Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Long Time Coming. You got to reach out to end the madness. And that's what this radio station is all about. It is people 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, reaching out in New York to end the madness, to bring about positive change, like our next guest is going to talk about. But we can only exist if people donate money. This is a listener-supported radio station. We don't have commercials. We don't have any fancy corporate underwriting. And we need listeners to support us. And if we don't get that support, if we don't get people to make those donations, if we don't get people to make recurring donations, so we don't have to chase you. You know, WBAI used to have whole weeks at a stretch. I'm sure Reggie could tell you. Where there was no regular programming. We would just have a fun drive week. We don't do that anymore. And actually, the collections have dropped. But if we want to avoid that, if we want to keep our regular shows on, if we want to hear the music and the guests and the culture and the science and the medicine and the that people talk about on WBAI, people need to donate. It's a small amount of money. If you give $25 a month, $25 a month will keep. It'll pay for one show, 1 hour, but that's a nice donation. So please go to WBAI.org, become a WBAI buddy. You can do that if you're listening online, just do it at the end of the show. If you're listening on the radio in your car, do it when you get home. I don't know if people listen to radio in their homes anymore, but, please do that and, keep us on the air. Our next guest is Anthony Feliciano. I feel like I've known Anthony for 20 years. We both live in below 14th Street. I live a little bit to the west. He lives a little bit to the east. He's been an activist for a long time. He was the Democratic district leader in the East Village. I'm in the Democratic district leader in the Central and West Village. He's now on the State Democratic Committee. But I really got to know Anthony when he was the, I don't know what you would call it, the executive director of the Commission on the Public Health System. And over the years, people fighting to stop hospital closings, people fighting to stop the loss of beds, people fighting to expand healthcare services in this city looked to Anthony as one of the real top experts that we had, who knew what was going on, knew where the pieces were, the chess pieces were, got out tons of information to people, was usually ahead of the curve on whether we were fighting the closure of St. Vincent's and then the attempt to close Beth Israel, and now we're fighting attempts to close New York Pioneer Hospital. They're always trying to close hospitals. They're never trying to build new ones or expand them in New York City. I've worked with Anthony, and now he's got a new job. He's working at Housing Works, an amazing organization. And so he asked if he could come on to talk about what he's doing at Housing Works. We're going to talk about both of those. So welcome, Anthony, to Advocating for Justice. And thank you. Can you tell us I'm going to play some clip on New York One that you spoke in about stuff that's going on in the state health system. What is your job now with Housing Works? What's the focus of what you're doing?
Well, first, thank you, Archer, for always having me, and always enjoy being a part of the show. So now my transition from the Commission on the Public Health System is now to another really strong and advocate, which is Housing Works. So I'm vice president for community mobilization, but basically it means I have a team with the Housing Works family working on advocacy around policies and transforming certain systems and making sure they meet not only our community's needs, but they address racism, discrimination, other barriers, other issues that are going on that are avoiding us doing two major things for Housing Works. Addressing the homeless crisis as one epidemic and also the HIV/AIDS, people experiencing HIV and AIDS. So that's what I'm doing now. Not very much different from before, except for some new focuses but it's always the same thing, fighting for a safety net, fighting for access to care, fighting for housing, and so on.
So there was just a couple of days ago, I think a week ago, there was you were on New York One talking about problems with the New York State Health Department, but you were doing it in your capacity as a Housing Works person. And I'm going to play that, and let's talk about what's going on with the state of New York under Hochul, and some of the issues you think we need to be highlighting here in the city. So, Reggie, if you could play that clip.
Dr. Mary Bassett was named New York's health commissioner a year ago, taking over a marquee position in Governor Kathy Hochul's cabinet. Less than 13 months later, Bassett plans to resign, ending what health policy analyst Bill Hammond says is the shortest tenure for anyone who has held the job.
She was there for a little over a year. The previous shortest term was 3 years. So, yeah, this is unusual.
Hammond believes there was a missed opportunity for Bassett, who could have helped reshape the department in the wake of the COVID pandemic.
We were the epicenter of the pandemic, and we were caught kind of unprepared.
Beyond public health emergencies, the next commissioner will have to oversee a sprawling public health bureaucracy. That includes Medicaid, the health program for poor New Yorkers.
There's a lot of stuff that the health commissioner has to be on top of, and the health department, there's a lot of things that need to improve at the health department, and you kind of hope that a commissioner would lead that process.
Advocates, including Anthony Feliciano of HousingWorks, hope Bassett's success will make support for low-income New Yorkers as well as LGBTQ residents a priority.
We're still in a pandemic. We saw the inequities very right in our faces, and we need to move forward.
And then there's the epidemic that started even before COVID. State lawmakers like Hudson Valley Senator Peter Harkham are pushing for a more coordinated public health response to opioid and fentanyl addiction.
All links together, we've got to break down all of the silos, and I think it would be helpful to have a health commissioner who's willing to try and break down those silos.
New York has seen a record rise in overdose deaths in recent years.
We are seeing in some parts of the country the overdose death numbers starting to level off. We'll have to wait and see in New York, but one death is too many.
So, Anthony, what, I guess you said part of your focus at HousingWorks, which deals with people with AIDS and housing for people with AIDS. What is the campaign that you're undertaking with the state? And talk about Kathy Hochul's stewardship of the state health system.
So you kind of heard from the other speakers, one of the things that is not just for, we're talking about people who are living with HIV and experiencing it, where we also work with people who use drugs and equity issues around that. So overdose prevention centers have been a very big part of our advocacy and a need to address in terms of expansion of those. I won't go deeper into them, but there's been this super reluctance from this governor to expand it with excuses of using the federal barriers to and regulations to not to expand them. And so there's been back and forth with her office on that. And we hope to continue fighting on that front, particularly when it comes to safer consumption and so on. The other areas that is critically important is obviously ensuring that the HIV/AIDS epidemic roadmap that the state worked with many advocates continue moving forward. But we end up having our safety net in jeopardy. This governor, in my prior position, has done similar to what Governor Cuomo has done when he was the governor in terms of undermining the healthcare safety net. And I'll tell you one particular big major issue for us at HousingWorks that we're working in a coalition of safety net providers is basically the 340B program. So the 340B program is basically a pharmaceutical drug discount program. It enables our safety net healthcare providers. And let me be clear, our safety net healthcare providers, we're talking about our community health centers and our hospitals that are defined as distressed or rural, but serving high amounts of uninsured and underinsured patients. That program enables the safety net providers to get a reduced cost of pharmaceutical drugs that in turn obviously is a reduced cost to the patient, particularly our most vulnerable and most marginalized communities. What's so important about it is a reinvestment of those savings go into the care that we have to provide for medically underserved communities. Expand access to services that somebody otherwise either are not funded or underfunded. And so what we're finding with this, what is being called the carve out of the 340B program, which basically is transitioning this program from the Medicaid managed care to fee for service. And that sounds all complicated, right? Basically what it is threatening the ability and the enabling of community health centers to do this other set of services that include providing not only low-cost medications, but also subsidizing costs for undocumented, uninsured, and underinsured, for offering HIV and STI prevention services and medication, subsidizing transportation, providing nutrition and food support, even sometimes finding legal assistance. We're talking about a range of program services that come from reinvestment of these savings. And so this government, in terms of this carve-out, basically is threatening that not only from both financially and the human cost. Financially, we're talking about $260 million cut to community health centers. That is not including the hospitals. That is just the community health centers. And not including the Ryan White Health Centers, which are another set of health centers. That's only other kind of community health centers. Then we're talking about leaving on the table $150 million that we get because this is a federal program, giving it back to the feds. So we're losing money out there. The other aspect of that is the human cost. The human cost is you're threatening marginalized communities that these healthcare safety net providers are serving. For me, an issue of equity is that this is inherently racist in a sense because when you attack a community health center and threaten what they do, you're threatening the communities that they're serving. And they've predominantly been low-income communities of color, immigrant communities, and marginalized communities.
Wait, so let me, I want to break this down a little. So first you're talking about services that had been free as part of the Medicaid program, right?
As part of the Medicaid program.
And it has been
free to low cost.
And now the governor wants that to be paid for by recipients?
In essence, it comes out that way. What ends up happening basically is when they're transitioning from one set of managed care to fee-for-service, you're basically carving it out and eliminating the ability for these community health centers to get those low medication costs. So what you turn the reinvestment of the savings get threatened as well.
So it sounds a lot like what we're looking at here. Big fight in New York City for the public employee retirees who are being pushed from a totally free healthcare setting to having to pay for it in order to save the state money. Or the city money in that instance. How is this affecting drug programs? You said they're not able to get drugs for low cost.
Community health centers have contracted pharmacies. There are community health pharmacies that rely on this program. And so you're basically threatening the ability to get those low cost medications in some ways, but you also, it's the reinvestment of those savings that you're threatening as well. Those kind of services I was speaking of. So just be clear that there are things that could be improved in the 340B program, but the state is not entertaining that with advocates. We've had many meetings with Hochul's office on the second floor and with the Department of Health and the Office of Medicaid and Services. The issue here is we can work together and improve the program. But the carve-out threatens that. And our safety net coalition, with many advocates and providers, and community pharmacists also believe that there's an alternative. And there's been an alternative conversation and proposal that meet many of what the city health department is saying they want to improve. And it's creating a fair, equitable way of addressing both the hospitals, the community health pharmacists, and the community health centers. And we still can't get this through. And what gets really scary is that there are a bunch of letters that are going to go out that will go to Medicaid recipients around this carve-out, around this program. And that's really scary for community health centers because we can see that. This is all, the carve-out is due for April 1st of this year. And 2 years ago, when Governor Cuomo was in office, it was able to be delayed. We don't believe that delay is going to happen. What we believe is to support an alternative plan that this coalition is working on, that we believe would make more sense, that also address, to be honest, a very ill-formatted proposal from the City Department of Health and the Governor's Office around this carve-out with real dubious savings that they think they're going to get. Really, they're pretty much stealing the money away from community health centers and from the communities that rely on that program.
So why, you guys are making this point to the governor's staff, one assumes that they talk to the governor. What do you think is driving her lack of response? You can be honest. Go ahead. You can talk about it.
You know me very well about this stuff. I really do believe that they think that they can take this money and use it elsewhere. I don't really believe that they can make their committed their promises of keeping all these safety net providers whole after they create that transition. It's very dubious in terms of even the numbers that they've been talking about. So that's part of the issue. The other issue is they're reading through the pendulum that's gone across this different states on the attack and threatening 340B programs across the country. California did a similar kind of carve out. It's not working. It's not working for the community health center. It's not working for the patients and the communities that rely on it. So it's part of that pendulum that's been going across countries, but it's also the very fact that, like always, the City Department of Health and the governor, particularly this new governor, is doing that same playbook about taking safety net dollars away from really serving communities and thinking that it's going to work elsewhere, and it's not.
And work elsewhere
within moving it to the fee-for-service program. And we think that eliminates any mechanisms that community health centers have to keep negotiating the low benefits and also doing the reinvestment to services.
Now, did the moneyed interest in the healthcare industry, when there are big money interests in the healthcare, even the supposed for not-for-profits have become moneyed interests. Their decisions are, right, you would agree with me, are mostly based on financial considerations and not on how to provide better healthcare for people. Do they have Hochul in their pocket?
You know, the irony is that there are a bunch of safety net hospitals, private and voluntary, including our public health system, that's with us in terms of feeling, knowing that this is a threat. There are community pharmacists and there are more mainstream pharmacists with us as well. So who knows why we continue having this situation, but there are certain associations of pharmacists, certain associations in the health plans that may feel as if they'll get a better deal if they do the carve out. But that's always the case in many states. But for us, it's about the savings and how it protects communities' access to care for particular services that are, like I said, are normally not always funded or underfunded. It stalls us even with comes to this major plan that came out around HIV/AIDS to end the epidemic. It stalls it. It pulls it back because it's talking about services that could be given less of, maybe cut for many of these community health centers.
How do people get involved? People that want to fight around this. I mean, because now you're not just an expert; you're the head of organizing. How do people hook up with you on this issue? And what other groups are you working with in coalition?
Well, let me work with the latter. Our coalition is very extensive. And when I say our coalition, it's the partnership. It's many community health centers from Cal and Laura to Urban Health Plan across the city and across the state. We're talking about Trillion and up in Buffalo and other. So this is not just a city situation. This is a all-state kind of coalition working on these things. We're talking about major set of advocates across the board that work with LGBTQI communities, but also with other communities of color and other marginalized communities and immigrant communities. So it's a very diverse set of folks involved in this in terms of a coalition. In terms of involvement, the major thing is that we're making sure we put enough pressure on the governor, given the budget that's going to be released on February 1st, making sure our elected officials, who many have been on board with us on this issue, for folks to make phone calls. We have actually a link I can say that people can go to do what they call phone zap, basically phone calls and emails to elected officials.
Well, go ahead. Support. Tell us, because we only have like 1 minute left.
So I go with, it's bit.ly/340BASinBoy action. Again, it's bit.ly/340BASin. That's a link that people can go to, or they can reach me. My cell phone, as you know, Arthur, is all over the place anyway. So my number is 646-325-5317 if you want to be more personally involved.
And they can reach out to HousingWorks if they can't remember any of this, right?
Correct. Because we're one of several hundred organizations leading the charge.
Thank you so much, Anthony. I appreciated your coming on to talk about this issue. Appreciate the hard work that you do in general. We'll check in again later as we get closer to the budget, which is not till, well, I guess they try to do the budget now in April, and see how things are going. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I get to say goodbye to everyone till next week. Next week, I'm going to do a show, built around Holocaust Remembrance Day. And I'm having this author named Richard Hurwitz, who just wrote a book about people who heroically saved people from being killed by the Nazis during the Holocaust. It's an amazing book, and I expect to have an amazing interview on a very solemn day. So I'll see everyone next week, and we're going to end with Carry On by Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
One morning I woke up and I knew you were gone. A new day, a new way, and new eyes to belong. Lord, you're where I thought might get gone. The sky is clearing and the night.
This is Ralph Pointer. Join me and others every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial. It would appear the human movement is such that at any moment in history, there are too few that understand possibilities of existence that would benefit all who inhabit this planet and are willing to act on this understanding. This program will feature that few. What are your views on these issues that impact your life today? What are your views on America today? What are your views on America's future? Can we talk? Call in 212-209-2877. Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial.
Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling. Some like to skip the costs of repairing, while others just enjoy the good feelings of giving back to their community. But no matter your reason, donating a vehicle to WBAI is a great idea. And it's easy. Here's how it works. Simply call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or give online at WBAI.org/donate-your-car. our vehicle donor support team will arrange your free pickup. When the driver arrives to tow away your great gift, you'll receive a donation receipt. Vehicle donations have the potential to drive hundreds and sometimes even thousands of dollars to WBAI. Call 866-WBAI-CAR or visit WBAI.org/donate-your-car.
The previous program was Advocating for Justice with Arthur Schwartz, heard Wednesdays at 5 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for the evening edition of Democracy Now!, followed by...